I'll ask Grand Canyon to come forward because we don't have the U of O reading folks here yet. And if you would be kind enough to introduce yourselves again so that we have that for the record, appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Kimberly LaPrad. I'm the Dean for the College of Education at Grand Canyon University.
My name is Carol Brath. I'm the Director of Compliance for Grand Canyon.
Is that better?
Yes.
That's okay. Better. Okay. I'm going to allow Keith to introduce this so we're all on the same page and then let you proceed.
Thank you. Thanks, Keith. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I just want to refer the commissioners to the agenda item. The proposal that was submitted included numerous programs that Grand Canyon is interested in bringing before the commission, but I wanted to make sure today that the commissioners understood that what was being considered was the initial teaching license only, with the endorsement areas that are listed on the front of the agenda item. So the ed leadership is being deferred, and some of the other endorsements are being deferred until a later time. What is considered today is the initial licensure program. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Grand Canyon.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I was promoted to dean 3 months ago, so this is new, but Grand Canyon is not new to me. I'm an alum, so I have a great history with Grand Canyon. And if I may, for just a moment, I don't know how much you know about our history, but we have a rich history in teacher education since 1949. And we are, at our foundation, a very traditional liberal arts university. It was in 2004 that we were bought and we went private, and then in 2008 we were publicly traded and became a publicly for-profit publicly traded company. And we have grown significantly, and much of many of our programs are now online. With that said, though, in the College of Education, our curriculum, whether it is online or on ground, is the same. So our ground students face the same signature assignments, the same syllabi. It is just a different delivery method. And it is up to the instructor to differentiate that instruction and model that for our students. And so I'm here today to answer any questions that you have, and also Carol Bratt, who is our Vice President for State Compliance, and to answer any questions you have about our programs.
I actually have a lot of questions. Because as I read through the proposal, it appeared to me that you still haven't tracked it with Oregon standards. That in a multitude of places, what I saw was Arizona fingerprinting, Arizona testing, and actually even some other state testing, but not Oregon. And if Praxis was in there for Oregon, that isn't necessarily correct any longer. Even in terms of tracking standards, in terms of a work sample, in terms of your coursework, it appeared that you used in-test standards as opposed to Oregon standards. And I appreciate that in due time, that may well be our standards too. However, at the present time, it's not. And I have to say really honestly that I don't think I could vote to approve it, given the fact that it doesn't track like an Oregon program.
I appreciate that concern. We use TaskStream as an assessment tool. And so for every signature assignment, our students have the ability to select the state standards that are appropriate for them in their state and are directed to do so. So embedded within the program, they actually are tracking to Oregon standards. Because our programs were initially approved in the state of Arizona, it's why you see much of your documentation not only for in-tasks, because we are a national program, but our initial state approval was in Arizona. But it does track, as well as the Orella is we accept that the APA.
But none of that is evident in the submission.
I thought we changed much of that to reflect the Orella in the submission.
It's not changed in the student handbook or the faculty handbook. I didn't find any place in there, and I may have missed something. It's a lot of reading, and I appreciate that.
No, it is.
I may have missed something, but in all the places I looked, because I looked specifically for it, it did not actually mention Oregon once by name.
They are directed by state, so it wouldn't necessarily maybe say Oregon specific, but they are directed throughout their program to list their state standards.
How will they know what their state standards are?
We use TaskStream as a assessment tool, and those benchmark or signature assignments are required to be uploaded into TaskStream. They have to attach the standards that they're addressing within that lesson within TaskStream. TaskStream electronically has every state, all 50 state standards, including all national standards. So students can choose those standards that are appropriate for their state.
That's certainly not evident in your submission. And it really would need to be made much clearer. And I'd actually like to see an example of it.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
As I said, I have a whole lot of questions, so I hope you don't.
No, please do. We are standards-based, standards-driven. We require our students to attach those standards to their lessons. It is a graduation requirement. We review those. The instructors do. They have to be knowledgeable about standards. They can't teach a lesson if they're not. And so it is fundamental to the program.
But I hope you understand that given what you submitted, there's no way we would know that.
I appreciate that feedback because we want to make that abundantly clear. It is at our core.
I have another question about all of your coursework is delivered online. Yeah. Is that correct?
Well, no. We have a biology and a chemistry, a PE degree that is not delivered online.
But that would not apply to Oregon, would it?
They could bring in their content through another university, perhaps, but they would not get their biology content or their PE content from Grand Canyon.
One of my questions about the online courses, I think if I read it correctly, they're all listed as 8-week courses.
Yes. Yeah.
Some of them are for 2 credits, some of them are for 3 credits, some of them are for 4 credits. How do you massage that to track to what we would consider a Carnegie unit in terms of the amount of time, et cetera, spent on a particular course?
It tracks in a very similar way in terms of outcomes and what they would have to produce within that course. We only have, I think, 1 2-credit course that is the Arizona government, federal government course, the POS 301. Our 2 3-credit courses that we offer are for our ESL, SEI in Arizona as a required kind of endorsement. And the majority of our courses are 4-credit. I would not say it's necessarily massaged. It equates to a certain amount of discussion, assignment work, and it has to be evidenced by, you know, the outcomes.
But how do you measure those things?
In terms of like seat hours, because you can't track a seat hour, they have to post a certain number of days online. They have to have so many posts. They have to complete assignments. They have to demonstrate their participation in very active and engaging ways. And we track those. In some respects, they're held to a higher standard in some ways than the number of hours that our ground students have to participate. So
when you approve those classes, mm-hmm. do you have some sort of standard that says this is the equivalent of a 2-hour class in terms of being on the ground, or a 3-hour class, or a 4-hour class? I just read it, and it looked like every class is 8 weeks, but it didn't appear in terms of what you submitted that there's any differentiation in terms of how much goes into that to be worth 4 hours or 3 hours. Am I being clear?
Sure, absolutely. It's no different than if it's an undergraduate course at a 300 level versus a graduate course at a 500 level. You have to differentiate that level, whether you're following Bloom's and asking them to do higher levels, or whether you're asking them to do more in terms of word count and assignments. It's a full spectrum. It's not any one just formula. There are certain guidelines that our curriculum and development team will follow to ensure that those students are participating in full, that they are meeting discussion requirements every week, that there are assignments that meet all of the objectives and topics, and that they're cross-referenced and aligned. You won't see a 40-page paper at a 100 or 200 level class type thing.
So if I read the syllabi carefully, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. I freely admit that I have not done, at least not carefully, I could see the difference in terms of the requirements in a 2-hour course and in a 4-hour course, for example.
Absolutely. If you're familiar with Understanding by Design with Wiggins, we actually used Wiggins and that process for our own curriculum. We believe in it so much. So we started with the big ideas and we worked back to the essential understandings. Our entire 4-credit model was based on that curriculum development model, and to ensure that we were really making sure that our graduates were meeting, were getting to where they wanted to go. Going back to our history, if I may, for just a little bit, in 1984, we actually had a guarantee statement in our catalog. We guaranteed our teachers, and it said if for any reason that a student going through an initial teacher preparation program had difficulty, at no cost to the student or the district, at the request of the student, the principal, or the superintendent, the university would provide support. I have been fortunate that our executive team has allowed me to bring that promise back. It went away in 2004 because nobody knew how to scale it when we went and we had online classes and we grew. And we went from 2,000 students to 20,000 students in the College of Ed. How do you do that? We do it the same way we do with our student teachers and our supervisors, our great faculty that are out there as adjuncts that help us, our mentors, our university development reps that are in your cities that can act as advocates as well. And for any student in the College of Ed that graduates from an initial teacher preparation program and they're having difficulty during their first year of teaching, the university will provide assistance, continuing education courses for refresher courses, phone-to-phone coaching with full-time faculty. We'll even go so far as to send a mentor, a university supervisor, back out to evaluate the situation and help coach that student to success. We believe in the excellence of our programs, and we're going to back it.
I have another question about your use, because you mentioned mentor teachers and cooperating teachers. Tell me how you differentiate between the two, because at times it looked like you were using them interchangeably. Okay.
The cooperating teacher would be the teacher in the classroom in your districts that are so kind to take our students in and mentor and nurture them to be highly effective teachers. The mentor teacher is the university supervisor.
Ah, okay.
So we have a cooperating, let's say cooperating teacher, and we have a GCU supervisor, if that helps to clarify. Maybe easier to call them.
How do you select the supervisors?
We try and use our university, the GCU university supervisors. We select first from our adjunct faculty that teach for us. In that way, they are familiar with our online platform, our management system, our policies and procedures. So that is our first line of defense that we try and go to.
In Oregon, they need to supervise 6 times. Will you be flying them out to Oregon so that they can supervise their student teachers?
If we have to, in most cases, we have, for example, I think almost 16 teachers from Oregon, actually adjunct faculty that live here in the state. Mm-hmm. We ask them to be supervisors for us locally first. We try and use our local adjunct faculty in that state because they are the ones that are familiar with your standards, mm-hmm. right? They can better mentor our teacher candidates than trying to fly someone from Phoenix mm-hmm. who's a program chair who's more familiar with Arizona standards.
Right. Earlier you were talking about meeting Oregon standards and using the supervisors to right. mentor, and I was worried about how familiar they would be with the Oregon right. standards.
The other thing that's also still in there is mm-hmm. that it says that you have 4 site visits, right. and Oregon requires 6.
We have 4 site visits across the board for everyone, you're right. On page 92, it will specifically say 6 site visits. So I want to clarify those site visits a little bit. The 4 site visits are summative, meaning they that is that end result, it's going to go into the grade book. So site visit 1 is a summative assessment. In between site visit 1 and 2, there will be for Oregon students a formative assessment, which will help them get a handle on where they are, where they sit. It won't go into the grade book. It will still be part of the task stream assessment portfolio, assessment system. Then they will have their site visit 2. So they'll have 1, then they'll have that formative, then they'll have 2, then they'll have 3, they'll get another formative visit, and then they'll have 4. So they will have 6, but I just wanted to clarify.
To make sure that it's clear in there.
So they will have 6 site visits, as outlined on page 92, but 4 of them are summative in nature and actually go into the course itself and become a significant portion of the grade.
I'm going to let look for that.
Okay.
I have a question about a student who might elect to sign up for Grand Canyon University that lives in a remote portion of the state and probably not in any proximity to one of your adjunct faculty. Mm-hmm. How would you address that? Would you take that student on? Would you advise them to find another program? What would you do?
We would take the student on, and we would drive or fly the supervisor to that location.
Thank you. Bob.
Currently, I know that you do have quite a few students in the state. Can you talk a little bit about, do they all currently have supervising teachers, and is your goal to have them with a supervising teacher before they start student teaching?
As of today, we have 16 student teachers. They all have been placed, and they all currently have supervisors, and to my knowledge, there's no pending issues. I will say that we did struggle. We were behind the curve a little bit at the start of this semester, finding the supervisors, making sure everybody had that supervisor in place prior to student teaching starting. I think as we've grown, we are, experiencing a lot of demand on our systems and trying to work as hard as we can to get everybody the services that they deserve and need. And so all of our efforts went full steam into that. We've done some major restructuring in our Office of Field Experience. My goal is to have as much of our resources as possible on the front line. So I've cut staff at the top to put more budget and manpower into that placement piece. We went from a field experience office of 9 people. We split that team in half. We went with our teacher education specialist, and now it is a team of 14 that are just working them from their fingerprint clearance card through their basic skills and their content exams that they have to have prior to student teaching to their actual placement. It then get those 14 teacher education specialists then, those students get passed to what is called the field experience specialist, who works really just on the academic, the supervisor, the faculty piece, any coaching, any remediation that would be necessary, and that is currently a team of 6. So that's been a big change, and right now I'm really pleased at the results that we've had to get all of those things done.
You mentioned the 6 visits.
Mm-hmm.
Is the goal to have that person come 6 different times?
Yes.
Might want to check on that for Oregon.
Okay.
People that you have on the ground currently.
I will, absolutely. And that's easy to do because not only is that that visit in the classroom, and we do have a quality assurance team that calls to ensure the integrity of all placements, including practicum. So while we have practicum verification forms and those types of things that are uploaded, we do have a quality assurance team that makes those calls and also even listens in on calls. So it's a two-way, and I will absolutely take that back. Thank you.
I didn't find it on page 92. Of mine, it didn't.
Carol's looking. Thank you.
Sam?
Yeah, I have a couple questions about the secondary program in particular.
Okay.
And so let me see. I'm looking at the...
Bachelor's or master's?
The master's in particular, but the question may actually relate to both.
Okay.
So one line of my questions has to do with authorization levels. The other one has to do with specific subject matter preparation. So I noticed that in your catalog, it refers to...
I'm just looking for some guidance on where I would find how it is that that you've attended to that.
We have these teacher education specialists that I spoke of earlier, and they are regionalized, and so three of them are dedicated to Oregon to specifically help Oregon students meet their goals in terms of their certification path. Part of this is a matter almost of semantics in terms of Arizona, where we were originally, our programs were designed to meet Arizona standards and NTASC as well. And there's semantics for endorsements, for example. We don't have endorsements in Arizona as part of our institutional recommendation process. What we have done most recently is we are testing state. And Patty Hardy, who is at the Arizona Department of Ed, often helps with those kind of issues that most recently we had one in math for middle school math. And it was a matter of making sure that that student had placement opportunities during practicum and student teaching for those areas specific to the endorsement or approved area that you speak of. And also that they take the appropriate test as well.
I'm not sure how that relates to our authorization levels for middle and middle school and high school, but